Hi, 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 ho. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of, it's murder, but like I like it. I am your host, Tori Lou, and in today's episode, we are going to be talking about Jennifer Pan, y'all. So, this case, like, I remember watching, I think probably when it unfolded, when 2014, 2016. No, 2010 is when it happened. But what I was trying to say, like unfolding, is like when I think probably the case was still going on. Maybe she don't think she got convicted until. I should really do my research, y'all. I know it when I look at my notes. I'm just trying to freehand talk. It was like 2014, 2015. One of those when I think she got sentenced, but it was like all on the news. And that's when I first learned about it. And it is just interesting. It's almost like a like an old wives' tale, kind of like one of those like tale, what are they called? Like Aesop's fables, like one of those where it's like there's a message underneath and like this message is like don't fucking lie. Because if you lie enough, you're gonna get caught in this web and then there's kind of no way out, right? I mean, she tried to make a way out, but not recommended. Anyway, this is a fantastic intro. Welcome back, y'all. Things are crazy. Things are weird. I'm just glad that you're here with me and that you're probably going to notice a couple of changes continuing to happen here in the year 2021 as I think the rest of the world continues to adapt. But and by changes, I mean changes from the channel. Sorry. Again, so much for an intro. But settle on in, drink your coffee, drink your wine, whatever time of day you're having this. For me, it is currently in the PM and I am eating banana pudding. Listen, it's the South, y'all. But let's get into it. Okay, so our story is going to take place in California, in I think you pronounce it Markham, California. I don't know. I'm not from California. Hopefully that's right. we're going to take a closer look at Jennifer Pan. Now, Jennifer Pan was a child to, I believe it's pronounced Bick, Pan, and of course her father, I'm going to say it like Way. Hopefully I'm not wrong. They were originally from China and they immigrated to Canada around the year. Oh gosh, no, 19. Let me look at my notes. 1979. I wanted to really, sorry, footnote. We're going to be all over the place, I think, this episode, as I really wanted to kind of make it more of a relaxed talking session. I did get some feedback that sometimes I sound like I'm reading from notes because I usually am. So I'm trying to make it more relaxed, but I always have to look at stuff because I'm always wrong. Now, they did get married in Toronto. They had two children. They had Jennifer and Felix. Jennifer was born first in 1986. Felix was born in 1989. And they worked, at Magna International, which is like an airport, an auto part manufacturer. So they make like car parts. Now, they, worked very hard and very diligently to earn money to give their kids a good life, as any parent would. I myself am a parent, and I work extremely hard so that my daughter can have a good life. That kid's wearing Nike, she's fine. But like, I work very hard so that my child can have a good life. And yes, people can say, okay, well, money isn't everything. That's true, but money helps you get to a lot of places. They worked really hard to just give their kids a good life and to give them a healthy upbringing and to just kind of open every door and avenue for their kids to find, enlightenment and enjoyment. And they ended up purchasing a big a large house, not necessarily like a massive house, but a pretty decent sized house, in about 2004. And I mean they drove I think Bick drove a Lexus and Han drove a Mercedes-Benz. So, I mean, they were doing good for themselves, all right? Now, to go hand in hand with this, and I think people call this tiger parenting, they set very, very, very high expectations on their children. And so she, you know, had to take piano lessons. She had to take figure skating classes. You know, she at one point wanted to become an Olympic figure skating champion, but she ended up tearing a ligament in her knee. She went to a Catholic secondary school. Some people don't like the way I say secondary, because I say secondary. So just doing it. She played the flute in band. You know, apparently, you know, her friends described her parents as being classic tiger parents, more of the pressure being on her dad than her mom. They monitored her extremely closely. Again, according to her friends, she was never allowed to have boyfriends. She was never allowed to go to dances because they were afraid that these activities would distract her from her academic commitments. At the age of 22, she had never gone to a club, been drunk, visited a friend's cottage, or gone on vacation without her family. Was an excerpt that I wrote down in my notes. So I guess we can kind of stress that, yes, she was very heavily handed by her parents. Now, I want to switch gears a little bit. We're going to do a quick just run through of her grades and her time in school. And then we're going to talk about her adult life, because this is when things get a little different. So she did have, you know, these high expectations. However, she wasn't like super great at school. She kind of did like, she was like a BC student, you know, kind of CD student. Like, she wasn't top of the class. She was just kind of bleh, you know? And she would, I think it started when she was probably in primary school, is maybe what you call it in Canada. And here I would call that like elementary school. I think it started then when she started forging paperwork. So she started to like forge report cards. She started to like hide test results. She started to kind of hide things so that she could convince her parents that, she could, you know, that she was doing well in school, because obviously if she was doing bad, maybe this isn't obvious, she wasn't doing bad, that pressure became even worse. The monitoring became even heavier, right? They became more strict because their needs or requirements from her were not being met. And so she eventually failed calculus class in grade 12. So she was rescinded her early admission. And she could not bear to be perceived as a failure to her parents. So she just started to lie and say that she was going to university, even though she wasn't. Now, it is during this time that she actually gets to meet with her boyfriend, Daniel. He apparently is like part Chinese and part Filipino. But apparently she gets into a mix with him, high school, kind of high school-y, college-y time. And they start dating. Now, her boyfriend is a lot of stuff. I think that he's a lot of things, right? He was, I think, kind of known for – maybe not known – I don't want to say it's like his moniker, right? But he sold drugs, all right? He sold drugs. He ran around with kind of a tough crowd. It was kind of a bent around the edges kind of dude. And I think he really fit what Jennifer was looking for and kind of a partner, because he was just on that cusp of dangerous, but not all the way dangerous, that I think that she kind of fell into him. And, of course, quickly leaned on him. And I kind of want to dive into a little bit more their relationship. But quick, a word from our sponsor. Okay. So welcome back. How was it? So what I wanted to dive into in this segment, I want to cover her relationship with Daniel. Unfortunately, I scoured my notes, and then I even was like, just – dash it all. Let's look for dash it all. What am I, 90? And try to find some harder hitting evidence about the relationship. I've watched a lot of documentaries covering this, and each one kind of describes a relationship as being kind of tumultuous, right? Like, she was like a lot. She was really heavy. she kind of like lived with him for a while because, you know, she lived on campus with this imaginary university situation. Or maybe actually check my notes because I'm not here fucking lying again. She told her friends, told her parents she moved in with a friend. I see. Well, you know, boyfriend. They were, you know, she was hot and heavy. She was very like into him, it sounds like. But also during the trial, sorry, we're going to pop around a little bit. His lawyer argued that she played the sickest games with him. She supposedly, around this time, like, you even know the scene that I'm setting. Jesus. I don't know if conversational talking is meant for me either. Listen, I'm going to find a rhythm that works with all of us. I promise. But around the time that her parents would eventually die. Okay, spoiler alert. We're going to get there. She like lied to him and said that she was gang raped by these like thugs, and then they sent her bullets in the mail with warnings about how they were gonna kill her if she talked. I mean, just crazy shit. Like, she just planned a lot of mind games with him. And it just anyway, played a lot of mind games with him. They went around back and forth. I think they kind of separated maybe once or maybe twice, and eventually would get back together. It was just kind of like I described previously, tumultuous at best. Now, during the time of this relationship, she's lying to her parents that she is at university. She's showing them, you know, fake admission letters and fake, you know, I don't know, what are they called again? Report cards and stuff like that, that she's doing well. She's studying to become a I can't ever pronounce this word. Pharmacologist? Is that it? A pharmacist? Because that's really like what they wanted her to do. So she was doing that. According to them, she was doing that. Now, she was really working as a waitress in a restaurant. How does the stroke taste? Oh my God. She was working as a waitress in a restaurant. Apparently she also gave like tutoring lessons on piano. But during this time, you know, they're touching base with her. They're reaching out, how's school, blah, blah, blah. Your brother's doing great, right? As a child with siblings, I know what that feels like. People being like, but your brother's doing fantastic. But your sister's out here doing great. What are you doing? And you just feeling it. So she's feeling it. Also, what baffled me, just choking on yet another stroke here. She bought textbooks. Homegirl was buying books. Them things is expensive as hell. Also, she could be like, look at me studying. Oh my God, I'm really doing it. Now, this gets deep. Homegirl is thick in it. She's thick in these lies. She's in debt because of these fucking textbooks. She's having to like, there at one point, I think she was staying with them for some reason, her parents, I mean, and they were like dropping her off at college every day. And so she would like go in, no, not college. This was after college. She got like a job at a hospital. I gotta check my fucking notes. She's supposed to have like these long hours and work on the weekends and, you know, just whew, all the time, you know, just so, so busy working at this hospital. And she would like go into the hospital, wait a minute until they drove up, and then would leave, would go to like a cafe and sit for like 12 fucking hours. I mean, it was just like insane. And I mean, it was getting heavy for her. Her parents were starting to notice the cracks because, I mean, she can't keep this shit up. She can't. I couldn't keep this shit up. I fucking can't. You know what I mean? I don't even have a good memory to memorize. I can't even talk. I'm just fucking stroking out. I don't have a good memory to memorize the truth, let alone all these fucking lies. So, I mean, it was just, oof, it was rough. It was just, oof, rough for her. And it just got, I think, really heavy, right? And I think it came to a head when her parents were like, So we saw you leave the hospital like right after we dropped you off, which is weird. She'd have to work today. Like, what's going on? You know, like, why don't you tell us what's going on? And she would eventually, I think, kind of almost got pressured to, you know, just got pressured to have to kind of tell them the truth. And, you know, so, oh gosh. Oof. Now that I'm checking my notes, it looks like he followed her around to, like, in the hospital. He followed her around at work to see if she was working. Obviously, she wasn't working there. He called her quote-unquote roommate, but apparently they hadn't talked in years. And then eventually she did confess that she didn't even graduate from high school, she wasn't in college, and that she was living with her boyfriend. So her dad was like, all right, so you're going to move back home full time. You're going to break up with your boyfriend. His name was Daniel, if I haven't talked about him. And then you're going to quit your job at this restaurant. He took away her cell phone and her laptop. He installed a GPS tracker in her car. And so all of this happened when she was 24 years old in the year 2010. So she had, you know, she really was a woman of two lives. She would be in her parents' house, this perfect golden child, right? Can do no wrong, straight A's. Just, I mean, perfect. Beautiful, perfect. She's working at a hospital. She's killing the game. So proud of her. And then she walks out the door. She's got a drug dealer boyfriend. She's a waitress and teaching some piano lessons. And she's going above and beyond to fucking lie to people. Two lives. Now, according to the article that I read, and I've read several in The Citizen, things really started. I mean, they were coming to a head anyway in the year 2010 because she was being treated like a child. She was 24, but she was being treated like a child. Her parents had no faith in her. The parenting was worse. You know, like, it's, I mean, I don't know about how anyone else was broken up, raised up. Gee, I'm just fucking stroking out. not sure. And I do not mean stroking out and any offense to anybody that's had strokes or knows people that have experienced strokes. Just trying to cut the comments before I even see them. I'm not sure about anybody else who's like lied to their parents. But I know I've lied to my mom a couple times. That shit did not end well. Oh, excuse me. That was an unprecedented intermission. unfortunately, I don't get to stop being a mom even when recording a podcast. Yay! but things are starting to get heavy. Things are starting to get deep. And according to this article, again, that I found by The Citizen, which was posted in October 2020, she apparently met with like an old friend of hers named Andrew, who was kind of sort of in a similar situation. And he was like, dude, the only way out is to kill my dad. And so she was like, yeah, no, like, yeah, you're like, right. You're right. I should kill my parents. So the plot kind of thickens. And Andrew introduces her to someone that he knew, and they all kind of get together with the help of her boyfriend to, you know, whack her parents. Now, it wasn't supposed to be both of her parents, again, according to this article. I read other articles that say that it is supposed to be both of her parents. I'm sorry. But according to this article, it's just supposed to be her dad. It was supposed to happen in the parking lot of his work. And then, you know, she would have to only spend $1,500. However, he ended up running off with that money and never actually carrying out the deed. Her boyfriend was like, dude, whoa, fuck off. I'm not killing people. Like, I'll sell tiny dime bags of weed, but I'm not killing people. So he left. They broke up. She was like crazy without him. So she was like chasing after him all the time. He eventually comes back into her life. According to this, the quote that I have here is, after a while, Daniel, her boyfriend, came back into her life. Jennifer was already convinced that she had to murder her parents because according to her, if they were still alive, she would never be happy with Daniel. So her boyfriend, instead of dissuading her, joined in on the fateful murder plan. Together, they decided to hire a hitman. The idea was to fake a robbery. The connection with the murderers was made by Daniel, and the payment was 10 grand. Now, what ends up happening on November 8th, 2010, is, and this happens in the evening, by the way, Jennifer opened the door of her house where her parents were already going to sleep at around 10:02 at night. She made the signal, turning the study light on and off. After a few minutes later, she sent a message to David, one of the three men, sent a message to David and one of the three hitmen they hired to proceed. The alleged thieves entered and took the parents and Jennifer out of their bedroom, whom they forced to give all the money that her family had in the house. When she did, they took her parents back upstairs, tied her hands and legs with a shoelace. Later, the girl's parents were shot in the head. The mother died immediately following. I've read other stories that have stated that her mother pleaded with the robbers to not kill or hurt her daughter, which like breaks my heart to think that like her daughter is the one who planned all of this. Just, I mean, oh my God, it just, oh, it hurts my heart that even while her mother is going to die, she's still, please don't hurt my daughter. Please. Now they both were shot. And oh my goodness. Oh, sorry. I like literally got a little emotional. Sorry about that. Now I want to go to this 911 call. So during this time that they're getting shot, I think one of her parents screamed for her to call 911. I don't remember how this happens, but she ends up calling. The operator says, this is the transcript that I have in front of me. "What's your name?" "My name is Jennifer. Someone broke in and I heard shots like a pop. I don't know what's happening. I'm tied upstairs. Did it sound like gunshots? I don't know what gunshots sound like. I just heard a pop. Someone screaming. I'm okay. My dad just went outside screaming. Do you think your mom's downstairs too? I don't hear her anymore. Please hurry. I don't know what's happening." And then, ma'am, I don't know where my parents are. So let me switch to my next kind of area of notes here. So he did survive and he managed to actually flee. Wow. He went to the neighbor's house who called 911 and an ambulance came, took him to the hospital. He was put in an induced coma. And then she called 911. While she was on the phone with 911 is when he ran off screaming. I see this. It's starting to make sense to me. Hopefully I'm painting a picture for y'all. Now, obviously, she didn't think her father would survive. He does survive, by the way, y'all. He does make it out. It's just very odd, right? So as he's in the hospital recovering, the police are starting to investigate. They're pulling her in for, for questioning. And you can see the full, questioning of her online. That's actually what I watched. I think it's like an hour long, but you can watch it. She's like trying to text people on her phone. She looks distracted. She puts on this very heavy act of crying. They like couldn't figure out how she managed to call 911 because supposedly she was handcuffed to a railing. Like her story starts to unfold even in this room. So during the entire questioning, they kind of take her story, they kind of like table it, and they go and start investigating. It's very odd that nothing was taken from her house. Everybody still had like money on them. The debit cards that were taken weren't used. Like it was just kind of odd. Like if it was a robbery, now granted, maybe not within the first 24 hours, but this is like a week and nothing's being used. So that's odd. You know, it's really odd. Supposedly she barely cried at her own mother's funeral, which is just, again, tragic. Like it just really fucking hurts my heart. I'm trying to find like a timestamp as to when her father comes out of this coma, having said survived. All of my notes just say that he came out of the coma. So I wasn't sure. And I'm sorry for my notes always being so short. I try to get like all of my resources from not Wikipedia. And I try to find them through primarily articles. Now, I believe there is like an actual book about her. As well. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get my hands on it, but I did watch the full transcript, full like interview, police interrogation. That's what it's called. Video. It's just odd. It was just odd. Anyway, going back to this, he comes out of the coma and, you know, during this entire time, however, I'm so sorry that I don't have the length of time, but this length of time, and I'm assuming months here, that can only go off of her word and nothing else. But he did survive being shot in the face at close range. And also, fortunately, he was able to remember everything that happened. He describes the incident differently than how his daughter describes it. And I'm going to see if I can actually find his actual story of... This is me Googling stuff while talking to you about things I should know. The gun held by a stranger that evening in November 2010 was pointed right at his forehead. Where is the expletive money? Wake up. Pan said the man barked. I was scared and I was surprised. In the family's TV room, after spotting a second man holding a gun to his daughter on his way downstairs, Pan saw his wife soaking her feet in a small tub after coming home from an evening of line dancing. Oh, neat. The person who was holding me asked another question. Where's the effing money? I said the money with me is not much. Liar. The man hit him on the back of the head. Minutes later, he was shot in his face while his wife was shot twice in the head. And three other men are each charged. Oh my goodness. I remember hearing something like he heard one of the assailants like comforting his daughter while she cried, which he thought was odd. Is what I remember this. I can't remember where I got that testimony from. And I'm so sorry that my source is failing me here. But it was like he heard one of them like consoling his daughter during the time. And he thought that was really weird because if this was a robbery and they've already killed two people, right? Because they think he's dead. Then why would they give a shit if their third victim was upset about it? And he thought that was really weird. And he gives that testimony to police. And police were like, what the fuck is going on? And so they start to look in on her. And I think it was like two more rounds of interrogation that went on for, you know, fucking days before she finally broke. You know, and they had all this evidence that she had never done anything, right? She's already lied to her parents. They understand the pressure that's on them. And it was just, oof, it was bad. So eventually she breaks and she, you know, kind of confesses. And I'm saying kind of confesses because she's like, okay, yeah, it was supposed to be like, I said these people could come in and like rob my house, but I didn't say they could kill my parents, blah, blah, blah. Then the text come out and there were text messages between Daniel and one of the assailants that were like, so-and-so wants to tap out. Hold on. I have them. No, God, not that. When is the best time for me to take care of my stuff? I need a time of completion. Think about it. Yo, pop, 10 stacks. Yeah, when you're ready. 5 each ting. Yeah, but you all the way and all 10 for you. Easy ting. Blah, blah, blah. And then they're like back and forth talking about like how long it's taking one of them to arrive. It's just like these crazy text messages. I won't be getting in your way anymore. Please yell these people to just leave me alone. Let me rest in peace. Last one, goodbye. What you mean goodbye? Congratulations to you and your friends for winning and putting me through not only the emotional pain, but physical, blah, blah, blah. This is her like describing to her boyfriend that she's like miserable and needs him back. Okay. So like these text messages are just strange, but it's between the boyfriend and the guy talking about money, talking about a good time for them to show up, talking about a good time for them to carry out these deeds. I mean, it just exposed, right? Exposed. So she eventually crumbles all the way. And anyway, she it's during her third interview. She admits to hiring them because she kind of has to at this point. And then Jennifer, Daniel, and the hitmen were all arrested. Now the trial begins. Aha, March 2014. I say aha because in the beginning of this podcast, I was floundering around because I couldn't remember when I recalled this happening. It started on 19th of March 2014 in Newmarket, Canada, and lasted 10 months. All pleaded not guilty to charges of first-degree murder, attempted murder, and conspiracy to murder. And then, of course, they have all of this fucking evidence, including more than 100 text messages sent between Pan and Wong, that's her boyfriend Daniel, in the 6 hours before the killing. During the interrogation, Pan and her friend Daniel told a different story. It was like she was not being attacked and then eventually was blindfolded. It was all just a fucking mess. Before Jennifer was carried off to prison, her father addressed her saying, "I hope my daughter Jennifer thinks about what happened to her family, thinks about what happened to her family and can finally become an honest person." Oh my God. She is totally prohibited from. She was sentenced. Sorry, she was found guilty of all charges. She is in prison right now in Ontario. And she is totally like prohibited from ever talking to her boyfriend like ever again. Now I will say during his trial, they were trying to throw her all the way under the bus, and were almost successful. But I mean, he was a part of it, so he got thrown in. Just some shit. Just some shit. But like I said, I think this is one of those cases where lying can get you into a lot of trouble. And I hate to say like the murder of two innocent people, two parents, to a child can be a story or a tale of you know, of a, I don't even know what they're called. It's driving me crazy. stories with meanings, what they called. Oh no, I'm gonna get 10 inspirational stories. But can be a, I don't know, a reminder? What the fuck? I can't figure out the word. Hopefully you get what I'm trying to say. They can be a source of enlightenment. Don't fucking lie. You're gonna get on over your head and you're gonna make terrible fucking decisions. I mean, holy guacamole. Now she has since said that she regrets what happened. You know, she's totally remorseful about it, you know, now that she's been in prison for, where are we at? I can't do math. Now I'm exposed. All my followers and viewers are going to be like, "Wow, she's a fucking idiot." You're right. I am a fucking idiot. 7 years. You know, now that she's been in prison for 7 years, she like totally regrets it. But during the trial, when having to face her parents at her mother's funeral, there wasn't a lot of remorse. Just seemed a lot of fake shit. And I think it's because I don't think she really cared. I think that she cared to continue to lead her double life and wanted that pressure from her parents trying to be, you know, get her to be successful to their, you know, level of success. That she just, you know, she just really didn't give a shit. So y'all tell me your thoughts. obviously we're going to be working on the formatting here, y'all, because your girl, I'm trying a couple new little methods here. Wanted to make it nice and conversational and kind of fun, but I also throw out a lot of facts and I don't want to get facts wrong. So I just don't want to mess up. I don't want to get facts wrong. I don't want to, you know, throw out a bunch of lies. I want to be as honest as I can. So I kind of will re-reference lots of stuff. It is GCS Criminal Psychology. It's called Jennifer's Solution and is an hour and 30 minutes long. That is what I watched. I highly recommend it. It's on YouTube. Highly recommend you watch it. It was very entertaining, but also you get to just see, hopefully you see what I see. Hopefully you see what I see. But again, so glad to be back, y'all. I missed you all so much. And I cannot wait to see you again in the next one. Bye-bye.